Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Wednesday, December 28th, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I'm joined by Carolyn Yeager, one of America's most dedicated and passionate revisionists. All right, Carolyn Yeager, welcome to the program. Merry Christmas to you and to all of our listeners, of course, and also Happy New Year. We got the New Year coming up very quickly.
Oh, yes. I love New Year. I do.
Good.
I have a special affinity for the New Year, which kind of came to me all around the 1980s. And ever since, you know, it's a big deal for me. I make certain kind of resolutions, and it's always comes naturally. And you know what, it always comes up for me what it is I want to do around this, about now, you know, after between Christmas, and it's always been great. So that's a big thing for me. Thanks.
Yeah, good for you. I wish I was better at that. I always, you know, try to make plans or try to make resolutions, but like most people, they kind of go by the wayside after a couple weeks. But that's good. That's good. That's a good habit to get into. So I'm glad to hear that. And well, you know, it's been a long time since we've last spoke, but it's always an honor to have you on the program. You have profoundly influenced my thinking and historical perspective since I first discovered your work. I think it would have been in like 2010.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
Yeah. And you know, you've always been one of America's most dedicated and passionate revisionists. You're of course a writer, an author, I guess former podcast host, and an investigator who has committed yourself basically to researching all sorts of aspects of World War II and German history since 2005. Your website is carolynyeager.net, and it contains numerous original articles, podcasts, and other documentation related to revisionism. You are also the author of The Artist Within the Warlord and Adolf Hitler You've Never Known, as well as Auschwitz, The Underground Guided Tour. And you also maintain the websites Eli Weasel Cons the World, which is EliWeaselTattoo.com, and January27th.org. That's Jan27.org. I have all of those websites linked on my website, TheRealistReport.com, and I've had those linked for a while, and I'm sure most people that are listening are familiar with your website. You can find all of your websites directly at CarolynYeager.net. That's a good way to, you know, to find everything, mm-hmm. as well as links to your books and that sort of thing. So I know that was kind of a long introduction, but
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I want to first kind of start out by just briefly discussing your background and work over the years. I mean, really, in my mind, you've really been a trailblazer in the revisionist movement. And I mean, again, I remember discovering your podcast and your website back in 2010. And boy, you've interviewed everybody. You've covered all the various aspects of German history, of other topics as well. You've gotten into political issues, racial issues, and things of that nature. So you've covered a lot of ground over the years. And just to get started, can you just this is always an interesting question to me. Can you just briefly tell us how you even encountered World War II revisionism, or like what sparked your interest in this topic, I guess?
Sure. You know, I have to point to the internet. Without the internet, I don't know how far I would have gotten. But I didn't get on the internet until around 2005 or so. I had a computer, but I didn't get on the internet because it was very involved back then. Where I was, you know, you had to have an internet provider locally, and then you had this and that. And, you know, I was very slow in using the computer because I'm that way, you know. I'm like, who needs this, you know? And I didn't think I wanted email because who wants all that mail, you know? Nothing. Just like that, kind of the way I think about Facebook and things like that. Now I've never been on Facebook, John. Never had an account or any kind of social media because I have this. I just don't want to get too bogged down and stuff, and it seems silly to me at first. But anyway, once I got once I retired from teaching, which was kind of a thing I did for a while at the end of when I came back to the United States, then I started using the internet more and more. And so right off the bat, I had this time and I found about 9/11, and I was reading about 9/11. And I was reading about other conspiracy type, you know, moon landing and everything, which I was suspicious of all those things already. And also the JFK. I lived through that and I never believed that story. And so I was going through all that. And of course, the Holocaust comes up, and I still accepted that the Holocaust must have happened, but I hadn't looked into it. Although I was always sympathetic with Adolf Hitler. From the time I was young, I remember in high school, I just didn't like what they said about him. I just wanted him to be, thought better of. And I didn't think it was, I just couldn't really believe. I think basically I didn't believe all that stuff, but I didn't know how to say it wasn't true either.
It was just like an intuition you had, sort of?
No, it was a feeling of sympathy toward Germany. You know, I'm German and I grew up with Germans. And so I always had sympathy with Germany. And I think maybe intuitively, I didn't believe that Germans did that. You know, I think that's true.
Yeah.
I knew too many Germans. I grew up with Germans. I had Germans all around me, and I didn't, that just didn't seem right, but I didn't argue about it or make anything out of it. But anyway, when I got into National Socialism and Hitler and found that there were talk groups and people who liked it and talked about it, I was happier than over any of the other things. I just loved that. So I was getting involved in that, and that is how it happened.
Okay, and yeah, and like I think I mentioned, it would have been like 2005 when you really kind of delved deeply into this topic.
Yeah, 2005-2006, I was really looking at all this stuff. And then by 2007, I was pretty advanced in it. In fact, I built a website all by myself, and I called it I was into the Jews and all that stuff, you know, and I had found Kevin McDonald, and I got on his old discussion group from way back when he was actually on there, and a lot of people were there. It was quite the thing. And I met some people, and I made some friends, and all this 2007 was so packed full of stuff. When I look back, I don't know how I did all that. So much happened. So I get a little confused though about just when it started. But I know that I woke up to the Holocaust, John, in 2007.
Okay.
And I knew that I came upon something that shook up my idea that everybody believed this, and so I had to believe it because I didn't know otherwise. And then I came upon something that showed how they lied, and this the head of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum, a Polish man, he admitted that he didn't say this, but you know, that he had lied about this, and that they had lied about the gas chamber there all these years, and that it was built, you know, all this work was done on it after the war, and all this was being said, and it just like hit me. I don't have to believe this. I don't have to believe this thing. Mm-hmm. I thought I had to, you know, kind of.
Right.
I don't have to. And I stopped right there and started getting serious about looking into it.
Well, good for you. Yeah, that's awesome to hear. And that's all. I now that you say 9/11 was kind of like one of your wake-up calls, I do remember discussing that with you, previously, and you know, in previous podcasts that we've done. And that, of course, I mean, as most people listening No, that was definitely my big wake-up call. And it's kind of funny
Yes.
because shortly after I
I
started.
remember you so well, John. I remember when you came on the scene, and you just advanced so fast. I was a little jealous, and a little, I sort of thought, who's this guy who is making such a big impression on everyone? He just showed up. You know, what is, he's so
Well, you know,
young. What does he know?
I was well, I didn't I mean I didn't know much, but I wanted to know everything, and I was just so just passionate about all this stuff. I wanted to figure out really what was going on in the world and what has gone on in the world. And I remember one of the first and I wasn't really so much focused on World War II or really any other historical matters. It was mostly just relating to 9/11 and the power structure in the US, and it became crystal clear to me that, you know, basically we live under a Jewish tyranny, and the organized Jewish community was basically responsible for organizing and carrying out 9/11 and all the, you know, the foreign policy blunders that we've seen over the years. And that, you know, led to many other topics, obviously. But I remember coming across one of the first sort of like more conspiratorial aspects of World War II I came across was Jim Condit Jr.'s presentation about how Hitler was, you know, funded by the Rothschilds and may have been Jewish himself, and you know, the Nazis were like Zionists, and that sort of perspective that used to be much more prevalent on the internet back then. And that intrigued me, and I was like, okay, what is this about? Like, I want to get to the bottom of this. And that led me to, I remember listening to a debate that you and Jim Condit Jr. did. And you know, at first I didn't know what to make of what he was saying. He was the presentation that I'm referring to, you could probably still find online somewhere. I know I think the first time I saw it was on YouTube, but you know, he's sitting there and just presenting book after book after book, and you know, I was so new to this, I didn't know what to make of it. You know, I wasn't like totally convinced by it, but I thought it was an interesting idea. And the more I learned, the more I read about Hitler, the more I reading Mein Kampf and reading some of his speeches and reading more of like the revisionist literature about the Holocaust and just about, you know, Germany's war guilt. And Udo Walendi played a key role in that, which we'll get to in just a few moments. But it became clear to me that Jim Condit Jr. and that idea really wasn't very well backed up at all. And in fact, the official World War II narrative, including this fake Jewish Holocaust horror story that has been just totally institutionalized across the entire world through the mass media and Hollywood and education and, you know, the political establishment. I mean, in my view, this is like the greatest gaslighting campaigns against the global public of all time. I mean, it literally is this complete inversion of reality. And that is so clear to me at this point, and it's something that is really actually pretty obvious if you allow yourself to like objectively assess both sides of the debate, you know, if you actually entertain what revisionists have to say and maybe sit down and read what Hitler had to say about things. I mean, it's just so obvious that what we've been told is just nothing but a giant pack of lies. And I'm just curious, like, what are some of the key conclusions you've come to over the years? I know that's kind of a broad topic, but I'm sure you'd probably generally agree with what I just said. But I'm just curious, like, overall, I know, again, I mentioned that you've covered all sorts of issues relating to revisionism, but also politics, racial issues. So I'm just curious, like, some of the main conclusions that you've come to.
About everything?
Yeah,
Anything
just
and
like in
everything?
general, like if you were to had to explain like your work in a nutshell, like the main ideas that you feel very strongly about or you're very convinced about.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, it's a good question because I think I have some answers that I was considering today, maybe, or yesterday, now I have to gather my thoughts here, because my mind tends to go blank when I'm like under a little bit of tiny bit of stress. I think Hitler is the biggest problem for people. This is what it was. The Holocaust is the hardest thing for people to overcome, I think, of all these things you mentioned, which I you know, agree with you on all of that. And I want to emphasize again, I think you're a very quick study, and you really picked it up so fast. And So I tend, you know, there's a thing, maybe he's superficial about this. Maybe he's not real, you know, how did he do this so fast? But now I know that, that you are real and that you just were, you're just that way. I think people are born with a lot of knowledge that has to be woken up into our, you know, into our consciousness. And for accepting a lot of this stuff, which is fought against by the powers that be in the establishment, is the biggest difficulty, apart from losing, you know, losing status and losing your place in the world and dealing with people, you know, what we call today canceling, being canceled, you know, and ruining your life, actually, if you want to get ahead, is really, it's, I think the Holocaust is the most difficult. And of that, I think accepting out of Hitler as okay is the most difficult. That it seems to me that's a hang up for an awful lot of people. You know, they talk about in Christianity, the stumbling block, that I've thought for a long time that Adolf Hitler is the stumbling block against rehabilitating Germany. They might be sympathetic toward Germany. You know, I'm thinking of people like Michael Hoffman. I'll mention that while he comes to mind before I forget his name. And others, many others, who are Holocaust revisionists and really understand it and are serious about it and still hate Adolf Hitler and say, like Jim Condit, that he was a bad guy and he was anti-German even, and he hated Germans and he wanted to destroy Germany and he did and all this stuff. I don't know why it's so difficult. Maybe it's something about the way he looks and the way he dressed and the way he talks.
Well, it's all the propaganda. I mean, all of the way Hitler's presented in Hollywood, yeah, and all of the newsreel footage. It's this crazy madman yelling, and you know, it's just totally taken out of context. And yeah, you know, and I don't think
some
most people
get over that, and other people can't do it.
Right.
And they just really don't like him. Usually you can find a lot of other things they don't like about what we're all fighting for, that kind of fit with that too. But it's just that, you know, and to me, he is the most attractive part of it. So not that he's particularly attractive, when I used to think he was quite horrible looking, you know, looked creepy and all that, you know, but I was younger then. So but he is really he's really what we should have leaders like him. He was a great, great leader, a great man. And it's just a shame that it's people have so much difficulty with that. So that's one thing that I've didn't always know, but I do know that debate. Did you say that my debate with Jim?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, yeah, I remember okay, hearing, yeah, a debate. That, yeah, I remember hearing.
Oh,
I think Deanna Spingola.
Disaster.
Yeah.
That was Deanna Spingola, and she wasn't tough enough, and I advised her before we started. I said, you know, make sure you have rules. And we have to follow the rules, debate rules and time and this and that. And she said, oh, I will. Well, she couldn't do it. And Jim she just let Jim go on and on. And then he kind of took over and he wouldn't follow any kind of rules. And he just said whatever he wanted to and then wanted me to respond to that like he was running the thing. It was I was so frustrated. And yet it comes across that people say they really were. Thought I was clearly the winner, and they really, it made an impression. So hopefully it did some good, because
yeah.
I was looking forward to it, you know, and but it's not as easy as it seems, because you can't control people. That's one of my biggest problems.
Yeah.
People don't want to be controlled, and boy, you just can't do it. And they
well, it definitely made a big impression on me. And I think I actually the at the, around this time was I remember you had Bill Fink on to discuss his website, the Mein Kampf project. And that, and I had never heard of that before, and so I started following his podcast there and downloaded all of them, like, and this went back a few years. And they would just go through and read, excerpts of Mein Kampf or other papers from Goebbels or Hitler or, any number of other German leaders. And it just became so clear to me that Hitler and the National Socialists in general were like the most righteous and honorable statesmen, who just worked tirelessly for the German people and really did, they sought peace and justice and prosperity. I mean, not only for Germany, but really for the entire world. And it was so that just was so clear to me after just hearing what these men had to say. And all of their critiques of modern politics or of politics then and the role that the Jews play are just were so obvious and so parallel to what I'm seeing in America today. I mean, it was like they could what they were saying back then perfectly explained everything going on in America today and really all of Western society. And that was just very clear to me.
Well, that's it's it that's what how some of us experience it. It's all become so obvious, and we see the connections between then and now, and we see how it relates, and it's all so clear and so easy. But for others, they can't see any of that, and they've got this. The other thing I would say is that they have resistance that is on a deeper level than what I had. Mine was pretty superficial because I really liked it, instinctively, even as a child. I liked Germany. I wanted to like Germany. I didn't like Germany to be picked on and so on. But for others who it could be religion, Christian kind of a thing, it could be their nationality. For a lot of Europeans, the nation that they're from is still pretty anti-German, or there's that in it, and they have trouble then changing that and turning that around. And I guess I would too if I was in their shoes. So another thing I was thinking this morning was that, I've been pessimistic about the idea of white people and the white race, and that we, can get something done for us and we can persevere. But it just seems like more and more that we can't and we won't, and we can't do anything as white people, because white people, it's our fault, because white people have been fighting among themselves for our entire history, and in the most atrocious ways, much more than we fight against people who are not European or white. And this has created a lot of animosity that is very hard to overcome. I'll stop there. I've said enough.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think it's hard for me to disagree with that assessment, looking at the state of the world today and just historically. What's amazing though is that there have been a lot of very righteous people who have stood up and exposed some of these problems, who have talked openly about the role that the Jews play, and who have tried to bring this information, bring this truth, bring this perspective to either America or other parts of Europe. And it's just been totally, they've just been met with such resistance from the state, from of course the Jewish press and the Jewish media and organized Jewish groups in general. It's just been a very, very difficult thing to overcome. And the most amazing thing is that Hitler and the National Socialists actually did overcome all of those obstacles and actually did attain power. And what were they met with? But literally the entire world basically ganging up against them to destroy them. And I mean that's really what this all boils down to, is that World War II was instigated and fomented primarily by international Jewish activists and organizations and politicians and other just influential individuals to basically crush and destroy National Socialist Germany and everything that they stood for.
Well, that is correct. That is exactly what I would say, and that it's World War II. Roosevelt was working very hard, and so was Churchill, to get all these other little countries to join this allied league, you know, alliance of the allied United Nations against Germany, you know. And I've got some good quotes here from, mm-hmm. actually from, I guess they're from Udo, from his book about just about exactly about that, that says it quite well, because they worked very hard to destroy Germany. And a lot of people will say, well, that they don't think that, but I think there is evidence that can be presented there. I know there is. And maybe they haven't had that presented to them yet in the right way.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing real quick, if you want to read any of those quotes, that's totally fine with me. I just wanted to say briefly, I can't help but also notice the parallels going on today with this whole situation between Russia and Ukraine. And it's really a broader conflict than that. And I think President Putin of Russia knows this, and he's explained it and articulated it very, very well. And I, you know, I'm certainly no like Putin fanatic or something like that. I'm just, you know, objectively looking at the situation where you have the West and Britain and the broader EU structure basically enticing all of these other countries that could potentially have a very decent, solid, and mutually beneficial relationship, economic and political relationship, excuse me, with Russia, just totally sabotaging that. And you look at how harmful it's been to the global mm-hmm. economy, to individual European countries, and it was the same exact thing leading up to World War II. All of it totally unnecessary, but, you know, here we have the Jews just manipulating everybody, and nobody and none of our leaders are even capable of calling this out and recognizing it.
Yeah, that's excellent, John. That's excellent. That's exactly right. And I hadn't really connected it. Well, I guess I just did, but that it's I with it going on now, it's the same thing. And you know, I was always I never could warm up to Russia because of their propaganda campaign and because of World War II and because they're still part of the allied nations that they're not going to be for long, but that push the Holocaust and push all these lies about Germany under Hitler. And but now this Ukraine thing has just changed things for me in that regard. I just hate what we're doing in Ukraine. I have come to hate the Ukrainians. I don't have any sympathy for them anymore because they're completely taken over. Again, just like the United States, by this Jewish control, and they're just a Jewish controlled country. That's all they are, and that's all they're going to be if they should win. And that I can see also that we're totally wrong and at fault in the way we've played up to Ukraine and worked for Ukraine becoming independent and joining the West. And having all these countries surrounding Russia on their eastern side as part of the Western alliance and NATO and so on. Why wouldn't they? How would they ever accept yeah. something like that? It's so outrageous. I'm just angry. And so I've become, you know, I'm very sympathetic to Putin, and I'm sorry that it looks like he's ill, and maybe Russia's not going to hold itself together. And but I don't know, just I do think though at the same time that we are in a time of great awakening and instability and things falling apart, and we know things have to fall apart for people to really see and wake up and for this power structure to break up. And so who knows what's going to happen. I don't worry about it because I'm so old, and I feel very lucky that I ended up being in my 80s at this time, or else I'd be very nervous. I'd be very worried about the future, you know, what mm-hmm. just how bad it was going to be, because I don't see we don't seem to be learning anything, and the United States is really the big bad guy and has been since World War I. And I wrote today something that somewhere, I don't know where, that United States is both good and bad, because I see the good in the USA and our Constitution, our beginning, our beliefs, our republic, our freedoms, and so on. I don't know any country where you're as free, even now, as you are here, even with the Jews so dominant, but they're dominant everywhere. And so, you know, there's good to hold on to, but really we have been the evil influence in the world for a long time. And I don't think that anybody else is going to do better, but I know that we're unfair. We're unfair to everyone. Here's this, this first quote I have here. I'll just give it from Udo Walendi in his book. And basically, it was never, he's talking about 1933 and the hostility to Germany. He says they were all hostile to Germany even before Hitler came to power. And it was never a question, because they were even already, you know, which is why we had World War One. And it was never a question of world views or declarations or principles of leadership, nor was it ever a question of political parties, but it was solely about Germany's position in the world. And these countries, Britain, the United States, and all the others that they got to join up with them, but mostly it was Britain and the U.S. too, as they looked forward, were jealous and were feared, and they feared the strength of Germany. And they wanted to dominate everything, so they joined together. They didn't think a thing of it, did they? Mm-hmm. They had that war. They killed all those. They didn't intend in the beginning that all those people would be killed, but it turned out that way. And they just kept going just because they didn't want to face a competitor.
Now, and I'm sorry, are you referring to World War One here?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I thought so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that same basic concept applied to World War II. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right.
So. Yeah, it's pretty outrageous.
So it's not foolish, and it's not paranoid, and it's not wrong to say that Germany was victimized in all this. And it was almost like from the beginning, if you really knew what was going on and how Hitler didn't have a chance. But at the same time, if he just gave in, it would be the same result. So by fighting, I think it gives a very good impression. And I don't know, it gives us a feeling that we can fight, we should fight, and how well you can fight. Well, now we're supposed to believe that the Ukrainians are fighting like this. And some of them probably are. They probably are sincere and they mean it. But they're being used, and they're going to be a mess.
The only
winners would be the United States and Britain, who's still trying to rule the world or something.
Well, but it's not even necessarily the I think you're generally right, but I would clarify and say that it's not even really the United States or
Great
Britain.
Oh, not the people.
Not the people, exactly. It's the Jews ruling this country.
Yes, yes.
And using our military and our finances and every, you know, political might and everything else to back this totally Jewish regime. I mean, the president himself, Zelensky, is literally like a Jewish crisis actor.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a total like absurd situation. It's almost unbelievable when you really understand what's going on. It's like, how can anybody go along with this? But that shows you the power of the media and propaganda in Hollywood.
Oh, it doesn't. Because I can't look at it anymore. I ignore most things. I just can't stand it. But the media, well, you have the media, and behind the media is the money situation, the banking and so on. And behind that might be they've taken over all the institutions. So they do it that way. But still, it's very tenuous what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, you already mentioned, and I previously mentioned Udo Walendi, and I wanted to bring this up because you actually wrote a nice little tribute to Udo Walendi on your website, carolynyeager.net, yeah, back in November. And we actually turned that into what I think turned out to be a really nice article in the Barnes Review. It's going to be published. It actually already is published. It was just sent to the printer, so it's being printed as we are doing this podcast. And this is the January-February 2023 edition of the Barnes Review, which I should mention, I hope everybody is subscribing to the magazine. Check out barnesreview.org for subscription details. It is really the last revisionist publication in America that I know of, and probably, I would venture to say, even much of Europe. And it still is a great publication, and this article, I think, turned out really, really well. He passed away on November 17th of this year, in Berlin, correct? He was born in Berlin and passed away in Berlin. He, of course, wrote his best-known book, I think, is Truth for Germany, The Guilt Question of the Second World War, which is available from the Barnes Review still. A great book. It's been a long time. I know I have it. I don't know if I read the entire thing, but it is an epic tome. It's a very, very lengthy book that basically just goes through and totally debunks the official narrative of World War II and how, you know, Germany was responsible for the war. Same thing with World War I, as you were mentioning. You know, it's this same basic fake story where it's a total inversion of what actually happened. And yeah, he really set the record straight and was a great champion of the revisionist cause. I know back in 2001, so about 21 years ago, there was a free speech conference sponsored by the Barnes Review in Washington, D.C., and this is obviously when Willis Carter was still alive, and he was honored with a leadership award, you know, for standing up for free speech and for revisionism and for taking all the risks that come with talking about these subjects, especially in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, he put himself out there right at the beginning, and so he was an early, early hero. For us, and yeah, there's not, he stands out. He's not known as much as he should be, really, but maybe
yeah,
that will
true.
Change.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Really very key, I think, very important, because he's so early. That book came out in 1965.
Right. Yeah. Originally, I mean, it was published in Germany, correct? It was published
just in German for, yeah, about 10, 15 years or so. Yeah. So, speaking of Udo, I was trying to read as much of his book as I could. I never actually read his book, but, I read so much about it and so many things. I've read a lot of books all the way through, a lot of them, but there's a lot I haven't read that I would think I should read, but I already know everything that's in it. And so I was refreshing myself about Udo's book, Truth for Germany. And it basically covers the war between Germany and Poland and the aftermath. And of course, what brought it on and the before it. So, and it mentions other things. It mentions later on somewhat, but it doesn't really go into, the Russian war and all of that. And I thought, well, I wonder what book does, because I think I know that David Hogan's book, which is very well known and should be, the Forced War, he titled it. And I want to know when that came out, if Udo Lindy's book was first. So I checked that out today, and David Hogan's book was first published in 1961. And that was in German too. No, I don't know. I'm not sure. I might be wrong about that. But Udo Willendi's book was published in 1965. So it looks like David Hogan was earlier. And then there's the recent book by Schwartz Ronhoff. What's his first name? Anyway, Gerd Schwartz Ronhoff. That is very well known now, titled The War That Has Many Fathers, That Had Many Fathers, I think, The War That Had Many Fathers. It contains more new information, like the Pataki papers and so on. I think Hogan has that, but I don't know, but it's all the latest update. It came out in 2003 German.
I'm actually not familiar with that book.
Oh, you must be. You're just not connecting it. The War That Had Many Fathers, if you Google it or just put a search, you'll see it. And there's a lot of versions of the cover.
Yeah,
and
okay, I see it right
he's
here.
Very well. It's He's also done some videos, and I watched one that was excellent. It really covers everything. He's speaking at a speech of some kind, and he really covers everything. And it's all about how the thing started between Germany and Poland. And that's the beginning, you know, that's what they all have talked about. It's very clear. There's lots of information and lots of papers and lots of documents, and you cannot, so it's a great story about how that happened. And I'm hearing my voice coming back to me a little bit. And, I don't know if there's any books that are as complete as these about the war later. I think it gets more complicated, and so it's not maybe so easy to sum it up, but it's so clear that when the war started, it was not Germany who started the war, who wanted the war, who brought it about. So that answers anyway the whole idea at the Nuremberg Tribunal of, you know, who brought this war on. It definitely was not Germany who did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, this whole original, you know, the origins of World War II with Poland, I mean, this is something that the Barnes Review has been covering for a long time, including this past year. There was we did a couple articles on the subject, including publishing, I think, pretty much in full Hitler's speech, where he discusses his decision to actually invade Poland, and all the pieces. It's so similar to what happened with Ukraine. I mean, it's literally like the same thing, just a different country, and it, you know, involving different countries. How, you know, all these Western powers, you know, the British and the Americans and the French, to a certain extent, just manipulating Poland in order to instigate this conflict. It's the same exact thing, basically, more or less, that happened with all these Western powers manipulating Ukraine in order to, you know, basically instigate this conflict with Russia. And here's Russia the entire time, for like the past almost 10 years now, trying to do everything in their power to respectfully and diplomatically resolve the conflict in the Donbass region, and just continually being disrespected and stonewalled. And even Angela Merkel came out in that interview and said that basically we just use the whole the Minsk agreement and these accords to buy time for Ukraine to perpetuate the conflict. And I mean, again, it's like literally the same exact thing that was going on in the lead up to World War II.
Exactly. I agree. You know, I have the same impression, and I feel really bad for Putin now. You know, he's really been stuck, you know. He wants to put on a show of strength, but he doesn't have the power to go up against what the United States is doing with all the way they're able to influence all these other countries. And the Jews, it's actually the Jews are able to do that. So he can't do much. He has to be respectful. He has to be careful. It's painful for me to see someone who's under that kind of, in that kind of situation where they're just about all their options are taken away and they're just the underdog for sure, and trying to save their country, trying to do something. He's now in the same place Hitler was in back then, and that may have dawned on him, of course. And
you know what's amazing too is no matter how clearly and articulately Putin will get up there and explain all this and explain the history of the way, you know, ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. and the West has you know, basically tried to destroy Russia and isolate Russia and prevent it from, you know, operating on the world stage. I mean, he'll go through this in painstaking detail, and he'll still be just totally demonized, either demonized or outright ignored by the Western press. So the vast majority of Americans don't even understand a single thing about this conflict, certainly not from the Russian point of view. And, you know, you look at him, you look at what he's saying, like, I've been that was the key thing for me was ever since he announced the invasion, the special military operation is the way they term it. You know, it's basically an invasion. Let's be serious.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, a limited invasion. But, you know, you listen to what he has to say, and it's like, how does anybody objectively looking at this not totally sympathize with what he's saying? I mean, not recognize the truth in the matter.
And I was never sympathizing with him, but I certainly am on his side now. And you talked about, he's trying to clearly point out just how this worked out, you know, what he had to do and what he's doing, what should be. And that was, again, it's the same thing Hitler did.
He was very
patient. He gave talk after talk, speech after speech, but they just dismiss it, you know, and in a sense, you know, they just piss on it. You know, they're so nasty and disrespectful. That was especially Churchill was to Hitler. And now I don't know whoever would be the one doing it now to Putin. They show him no respect at all.
Yeah. Biden, Blinken.
Oh,
any of the other Jews in the Biden administration. It's horrendous.
And yet, why can't we get our people to see this? Now, you mentioned invasion. That's one key. If you can, and this is what they always do, the Anglo-Americans, they set it up so that their enemy is going to be the one that does the invasion, you know, and they are very clever about that. And they have the capacity, the head start or whatever to do it. So once you're the one who's invaded, it's easy to tell people they invaded. They're the invaders. They're in the wrong. They're, you know, and not to hear any of the rest of it.
Yeah. Well, and again, I mean, this going back to what all the points Hitler was making about Poland and how all the ethnic Germans that were, you know, on the other side of the border, basically after the Treaty of Versailles, how they were being mistreated, and you know, they tried so many times to come up with solutions and to rectify the situation, and just continually they would be dismissed and disrespected by Poland and all the other Western powers. Same thing with the whole, you know, conflict in the Donbass, which has been going on since 2014. And like, it's hard to know exact numbers, but the figures that I've seen and the figures that the Russians always cite are like at least 15 to 20,000 people that have died, innocent civilians, caught up in the middle of this conflict where Ukrainian forces are like bombing and shelling like cities and civilian centers, you know, going back to 2014. And this is just totally unreported, unmentioned.
Nobody knows about this.
That's what I mean.
You know, I've read that since, you know, recently, and I thought, I didn't know that was going on. At first I thought it was a lie because I never heard of it. So,
it's amazing how they can just manipulate the facts and totally leave out, you know, key parts of the story. And it's, you know, again, the parallels are so striking. And somebody like Udo Walendi, you know, basically pointed this all out with World War One, World War Two. And I mean, I'm sure he'd be sitting, you know, thinking about this conflict today. It'd be interesting to hear what he'd have to say about it. You know, he'd probably be drawing all sorts of parallels to what was going on leading up to World War Two.
Well, he may have, because he just died in November.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably what I mean.
Yeah. But, you know, again, it's their control of media that does it. I don't know. You know, I'll just throw in here that I can't stand Fox News anymore. And I don't know what, I wish we had a better media. I wish we had a better, you know, truth media or something. Right-wing media, but we don't. I started watching one show on Newsmax, and I looked into Newsmax before. I like to follow what's the main stories are. I don't like to be ignorant of it, but so I look at Fox News, but I'm so fed up with them that I look into Newsmax, but they're missing so much, and they've got these horrible commercial and you have to watch it like TV. They don't put clips and things like that's how I see Fox, because I don't watch I don't have TV and I don't watch Fox on TV. I just go to the website and see what's there. But they have really become pretty bad, and they're anti-Trump now. And because of a failure for there to be anyone better, I'm still supporting Donald Trump for the Republican nomination. People say, well, none of that makes any difference. Well, it does make a difference. It makes a difference who's going to be president. A lot of things that are said about Trump that, you know, he's just he's just following orders. I don't believe that. He's not. But he does have beliefs, and he does also have enough realism in him to know that he can't just dismiss the Jews and survive. So, he does a lot, but he's still, in my eyes, the best alternative, because there isn't any. There aren't any.
Certainly not in mainstream politics, that's for sure. I'm curious.
If you're not in mainstream, you're not going to get elected. You don't have a chance. For white people and white nationalists and so on to think that they can get somebody they like, and even Kanye, we were going to discuss him a little bit, bringing him up, he doesn't have a chance either. No chance in hell.
Right.
Forget it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So, yeah, there's actually two other topics for sure I want to get to. One of them, definitely is the controversy surrounding Ye, as he's known as now, mm-hmm. who, of course, is formerly known as Kanye West, and some of the pro-revisionist, quote-unquote, anti-Semitic comments he's made over the course of the past few months. And this is something I've been writing about pretty regularly in both American Free Press, and I also published an op-ed in this current edition of the Barnes Review, which is titled An Unlikely Ally in the Battle for Truth. And I mean, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I frankly don't know. I don't know what to think about Kanye West, because I mean, obviously I've never met the man. I have not really followed his career. I mean, I'm familiar with some of his songs just, you know, through hearing them, you know, mm-hmm. either out in public or, you know, at a restaurant or whatever. I really don't know much about him. I do have to say, though, that he has come across as sort of like kind of a bizarre character. I think he seems to me to be a pretty genuine person. But he isn't the most well-spoken. He's not the most articulate. He seems to have a good sense of what's right and wrong and what's true and what's not. But that doesn't mean he's going to be the best spokesman, and that might not even be his role. But to me, just the fact that he got up on a big-time platform like the Alex Jones Show and openly disputed the official Holocaust story, for example, made mm-hmm. positive comments about Adolf Hitler and the quote-unquote Nazis. I mean, that to me is incredible. That's something that's like a breakthrough that I've been waiting for somebody to get up and say in a big-time way for a very, very long time. And he certainly did that. Whether or not it was the most articulate thing that's ever been said about revisionism or from a revisionist perspective.
Whether he really knows what he knows very much about it is questionable, but he's on. He understands about the Jews, and I also think it's very important. And I took notice, very much so, and I'm still noticing. But you know what? It seems like, I think I already said this to you. It seems like they're not going to let him say anything. They're just ignoring him. They're going to smother him with no attention, no coverage, and that's how they're going to. Because he just kind of faded away. They're not hurting
him. He really has. Yeah. He really has, like, since this all began. And, I mean, just to kind of recap it, it really sort of began in October when he went to that fashion show. And he wore mm-hmm. that White Lives Matter shirt. Mm-hmm. And he was with that conservative talk
Candace.
Show. Yeah, talk Owens. Show host Candace Owens. who is a major critic of BLM and says some, you know, good, some good, interesting things for sure. But I'm not like a huge Candace Owens fan, but she does say some interesting things and some very truthful things.
Too.
But anyways, you know, that was like the big no-no right off the bat was, you know, he's wearing a White Lives Matter shirt, which the ADL, of course, has denounced as like a white supremacist slogan. I mean, these people are just the biggest hypocrites ever imaginable. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow they basically control what can and can't be said in polite society in America. So anyways, that's where it kind of began. He went on the Tucker Carlson program shortly after that and basically doubled down on, you know, his decision to wear this shirt and talked about some other, you know, kind of controversial topics. And was basically sort of getting into the Jewish question in that interview. And then after that, he really – what was his tweet was to go DEFCON 3 on the Jews. He made a tweet mm-hmm. when he actually had a
yeah.
Twitter profile.
Yeah, I saw all of that.
Yeah.
I guess somebody would send it and I'd turn, you know, a link to the YouTube or something. So
well, I mean, this at the time, I mean, for like a month or two, maybe even close to 2 months, I mean, Kanye West was like dominating the news cycle, like every week, basically.
But I don't think I saw it. I think I saw it. I don't think they showed it much. I think I saw it on a YouTube video that I wouldn't normally see because I don't even check YouTube. I'm not a YouTube follower or a video follower, but if it's something I am glad to look at, and I think that's how it happened, I'd get links somewhere.
Okay. Well, it definitely made a big splash. I mean, it was like the most trending topic on Twitter,
yeah.
and people were talking about it everywhere. Whether or not – I don't really watch like mainstream corporate news anymore, so I know that it was definitely even covered there, but mostly on social media, on on YouTube and independent mm-hmm. media and stuff. It was really mm-hmm. like the story for at least a month, maybe even longer than that. But in some of these, you know, these interviews that he went on, and he was much better spoken, I should say, than I think he was on the Alex Jones program. He's a little bit more like bizarre sort of sounding.
He was.
In that interview.
That crazy mask,
previously,
you know. That does,
yeah,
you know.
The mat. Yeah, exactly. But in some of these previous interviews, he was basically explaining and insinuating that a powerful network of Jews basically control and manipulate and exploit celebrities. And also have, obviously, you know, tremendous influence in society, especially politics and media. I mean, this just made these organized Jewish groups just apoplectic.
Right.
You know, they were just going nuts and demanding him to be canceled and to have all of his business contracts and deals totally shut down, which, of course, happened. And, you know, he sort of explained – in one interview in particular, he was explaining how Jews operate as handlers. And he specifically cited Rahm Emanuel and Jared Kushner, who were basically, you know, the handlers of either President Obama at the time or President Trump at the time. And now you look at, you know, the chief of staff of Biden, and it's this Jew, Ron Klain. So, I mean, you have a Jew right at the pinnacle of power, basically, sort of behind the scenes. I mean, you know, these people weren't major, major public figures like other, you know, cabinet members or the president certainly is. But they are basically at the key position of influence, you mm-hmm. know, can kind of control things behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And this is something that he openly pointed out and specifically mentioned that these are Jews and, you know, they have a very sinister agenda. And this is something that is just never talked about, certainly in the mainstream. And here's Kanye West, a very, very popular cultural icon for decades now in America. I mean, he was one of the wealthiest celebrities. He was worth over $2 billion. He had a mm-hmm. huge following on Twitter. I think he had over 32 million followers when he was finally deplatformed and banned from Twitter. Obviously, a huge social media presence on Instagram and Facebook and stuff like that. So, and not to mention, I mean, he was a very, very popular musician. And I didn't know this, but apparently even, you know, he's big into fashion and stuff. So he had some influence
oh,
there
yeah,
as well.
He goes into everything. He designs shoes and sweat
right,
and these
right.
pullover hooded things. Mm-hmm. And people want to buy them. You know, a lot
yeah,
of black
yeah.
people, where they get all that money, I don't know. But they have a lot of money. They do have a lot mm-hmm. of money.
Well, and this kind of leads up to his appearance on Alex Jones, where he just totally doubled down on all of these topics and went even further and basically just openly disputed the most sacred narrative in modern Western society, which, is, of course, is this idea of a Jewish Holocaust, which, I mean, again, like, you know, the basic point that I would try to make to people is that this story is just not true. And it has been entirely debunked by honest and professional historians and investigators and other scholars. I mean, conclusively, it's not even open for debate at this point. It's all been published in the Holocaust Handbook series. The Barnes Review has, you know, carried a lot of these books. And I mean, so basically, I guess what I'm trying to say is that this should not even be debated at this point. It has been so conclusively proven that the official story of the Holocaust is just simply not true. And Kanye West didn't basically, you know, say it in those terms, but he did openly dispute the 6 million number and went on to say that Hitler had a lot of redeeming qualities and, you know, there was a lot of good Nazis and things like this. So anyways, I thought it was a very important moment in American politics, in American culture, in American society in general. And, you know, we'll see what, you know, obviously, you know, we've kind of alluded to what's happened in the aftermath. It's basically been silence. And I think at this point, that's probably going to be the most effective strategy for the organized Jewish community and, you know, just the Jewish press in general to maintain. Because anytime they cover it, it just gets more attention and gets more people.
They don't want it talked about. They don't want it to be talked about.
Right.
And now, this might seem kind of silly, but, you know, then you have this other black celebrity, Whoopi Goldberg, who keeps coming up with this kind of silly story that she has, which I don't buy into, but, you know, that this was inter-white fighting or something at the Holocaust. And it wasn't about race. It wasn't about Jews, because Jews, they think Jews are white, and they think they're Jews too. I mean, Kanye has said we're Jews, and she says, you know, we're the Jews. So, you know, they have their own thing, and I don't buy into it. I don't agree with it. But and I don't think they're smart enough to carry this on, you know, to make this into anything. It's just kind of nonsense. It's like they were the kings in Africa and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of crazy. Yeah. But the fact that they're saying it makes me really happy. Everybody's freaking out. And all their Jewish coworkers.
Yeah.
Like Whoopi's Jewish fellow people on her program there. What are you going to do? You got to shut them up. She needs to be kicked off that program, The View. She can't be on there anymore. Kick her off. That's their only, to shut them up, because they can't argue with these people because they're their left wing heroes, or they're the black heroes and heroines or whatever. So it's really interesting from that point of view too. It's fun to watch it and see, well, I wonder what's going to happen here. But if they just get silenced and then that's the end of it, that won't be a good ending.
What's interesting is due to these hysterical and like over the top and just totally emotional, hysterical reactions from groups like the ADL and other Jewish leaders and figures, and some of the articles that they write, you know, just their total reaction proves every stereotype about the Jews, about their power, about their influence, about their ability to silence people that even make basic legitimate points about what they're doing or their power and influence, or just even challenge any of their basic narratives, which, again, I mean, going back to what Whoopi Goldberg said, and this isn't the first time she said it, as you mentioned, she said it back, and I think it was in February or March of this year.
Yeah.
And literally like the very next day after she made these comments about the Holocaust being not about race, who do they have on The View? They have Jonathan Greenblatt show up on The View to basically set the record straight into lecture them about, you know, how to properly discuss the Holocaust. And I mean, it's just so revealing. And I think this has really I mean, based on, you know, some of the reactions on social media, people are seeing through this and recognizing what's going on, which is a good thing. I mean, anything that promotes these ideas in the mainstream and gets it out there in front of people, because people need to be confronted with this information. They're not going to the only way you're going to discover this stuff is if you're like how we were when we were sort of waking up to this. We were motivated somehow, you know, instinctually, or just we had something in us to seek out this information. Most people are not like that. They're not going to seek out this information. It has to be they have to be confronted with it in some way. And this would probably, in my view, be a better way than, you know, trying to, you know, go on their Facebook feed and, you know, posting stuff for them to check out.
Oh, yeah. I think that the never blacks works. Are saying this. Yeah. I think this black's doing this, and the more of them, the better. I think it's very effective because the left has a big problem with, you know, shutting them down because they're always, you know, saying therefore the blacks are oppressed and they are good and so on. But I think these are tremblings that are going on that are signs that things are shifting and changing. I agree with you 100% on this. And I think that anything might happen. We don't know who will come out next and say something. Mm-hmm. But it's very important for someone and for black people. These are someones, you know, these are people who have a lot of money and success, and that, you know, that counts for a lot, who have made it, who, if they say these things, it makes you say, wow, maybe they're right. Just like for me, I needed to hear something, whatever it was. Oh yeah. To hear how they were lying, to say, hey, they lied about this. What else have they lied about? And the whole thing started. I just said, I'm not going to believe it anymore. I don't have to believe it. And so I looked at it differently. And if this could start happening, you know, with a big group like black people, or, and there's others, not just blacks, who listen to this and listen to them, it starts shaking the things. And that's why, of course, the Jews are going to go nuts about it. And it's funny. We should really enjoy what there is of it. I just hope that they can't shut it down. And probably considering, you know, I think, again, I think we're in a very changing time. And one of the signs is how fast everything moves. And so something hardly begins, and it's, you think, is that over already? New things are pushing up. Everything is moving so fast. And of course, for me, at my age, when you're old, it really goes fast. Time goes by fast, faster and faster. So I may be exaggerating that because of that. But still, I know that time is actually literally speeding up. And that's what it does because, well, look, we know that in the past, as we're told anyway, we don't know. I don't know. But it took, you know, thousands of years for some change to happen. Now they're happening very quickly, and they say, well, it's because we got into technology. Well, okay, but that's still, you know, we're into it. What we have now just is moves and changes very fast. And so who knows what's just around the corner. That's why I think, boy, I'm lucky I'm still around. I get to watch this, and I don't have to have the worries about it that and the concerns that I would have when I was younger, because I tended to worry a lot. So I feel like I'm sitting in a very good spot, and I want to stay around and see how it works out.
Yeah. You know, the only last point I want to make about the whole Kanye West situation is it almost at this point, and who knows what's going to happen, this could change, but it almost feels like a sort of like a lost opportunity. And by that, I mean, he sort of just, it seems like anyways, went out and like sort of did this on his own, and then almost immediately, you know, in the aftermath, he's connected to Milo Yiannopoulos, who I'm very, very suspicious of. And Nick Fuentes is now involved, who, you know, I know he's people either love him or hate him, it seems like. And you know, I think he's done some good things over the years. I don't really follow his work all that closely, but it's just sort of interesting how he teams up with these guys when to me, and this is
well,
a point
who else
that,
is he going to team up with?
Well, this is what I'm getting to is why wouldn't he team up with like a natural ally and like a Louis Farrakhan or something like that? You know, somebody that's actually black, number one. And, you know, that's been on the front lines of this and exposing these things for pretty much his whole entire career. And these are points that I've heard other people make, and it's just so true. It almost feels like it, I mean, it's a good development. Like, just the fact that he went up there and said that on Alex Jones's program and exposed this stuff to millions of people and all the other interviews that he did. But I don't know. I guess what I'm getting at
well,
is
you know,
that maybe
you know,
it could have been maybe
that,
it could have been handled better.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I do have an answer that comes to me for that, that if he had connected with Louis Farrakhan is a very well known, and he's got a big organization. He's going to be in charge, and Ye would just be, you know, on his team. And this Ye strikes me as being extremely independent, and he's not going to follow anybody. You know, he's going to do his own thing. Says he's going to run for president because, you know, he has to be the boss. He has to be on top. So he's not going to join something. And this way he's the boss and Nick is working for him and Yiannopoulos is working for him. And that's just how he is.
Mm. I should point out that apparently Yiannopoulos is not working with him anymore.
No,
but I know he was for
a
period there.
Long.
Yeah,
that was that came out. So I think the whole thing is not, of course, nothing. It's not well thought out. He doesn't plan things, and I don't think he's going to because I'm pretty sure he sincerely believes that God is in control and is running things for him, and he's going to listen to God and do what God tells him to do. So he's not going to create an organization and do it that way. And so if God is not giving anything, he's not doing anything. He'll wait. And so it's going to be kind of weird, and it might not go much beyond what we've gotten so far, but something will. I don't know if I've said everything I had to say, I guess. That's why. But I do think that he's not going to be controlled by anybody, you know. He's very clear about that.
Yeah.
And that's why he's so weird. He does things in such a weird way. And it doesn't look very good. But it looks to me, though, very sincere. I think he's very sincere. And
that's definitely my impression as well.
Yeah, and that counts for a lot, even if you don't know what you're doing. He doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't even say he knows. He's being led by God. He believes this. And black people are pretty big into that, aren't they? You know, believing, and they can accept. They're not big for planning and organizing. Unless they've learned it from whites, or the Jews are doing it for them. That's why mainly the Jews have been running the black groups all these years and doing that work.
Yeah, well, and that's been sort of another revealing aspect of this all is that you know, they're coming out in all these articles and news appearances talking about how, oh, no, look, we need to team up together to fight white supremacy, and we should be on the same team, and you can't criticize us. And that sort of thing, sort of just revealing their whole agenda this entire time. So, but anyways, it is an interesting development, certainly. Something that I did not expect to happen, but I think it is a very welcome development in my eyes. We'll see what's going to come of it at this point. I haven't seen much about Kanye at all the past, like, month.
No.
And even following, like, Nick Fuentes, I follow him on Telegram. But I don't really see him even really posting much about it. At least I haven't seen anything lately. But then again, I'm not like on Telegram all day, like checking this stuff out. So
no, I don't even know what Telegram is. But I can say from my perspective that I'd heard of Nick Fuentes and mostly bad things. But he was a white nationalist of some kind. But I didn't really know anything about him and never listened to him. And then after the what's that big show with what's his name? Huh? the guy that everybody that is a big
it's a big podcast program.
I'm stuck here. The thing you were talking about, the
Alex Jones?
The Alex Jones, yeah. After that Alex Jones appearance, I got hold of a link to a little podcast that Nick Fuentes did after that. And it was just him talking, and it was only like about 20 minutes or something like that. And I watched it, and he was very well spoken in that. And he led into it, and then he was like, okay, he talked about the Jews and how they control things and what Kanye said and God, and he's a Christian. And he sounded and presented himself, as he did when he was with Kanye, as a serious and sincere Christian, and why Kanye was following, you know, God's wishes, and why he believed it all, and why Kanye shouldn't be judged for this. And it was really very good. I didn't see anything in it to object to from my perspective.
I think I also saw a part of that, if not the whole thing, of the Nick Fuentes sort of monologue on this. And yeah, it was,
yeah,
I agree. Look, I mean, everything he's saying is spot on. What's interesting, though, is like back in the day, he would like, he made this like huge division with people talking about Hitler and revisionism and even talking about like Jews openly. And now he's the one doing it. So I just find that a little bit interesting. It's kind of a weird twist to all of this and a little bit hypocritical, frankly. But I mean, I'm glad he's doing it. Don't get me wrong. I'm glad that he's out there saying these things and seems to be, you know, doubling down on this. And he does, again, seem genuine about this all. So I think a good development.
Yeah, what I wanted to say was that I think when you connect it with Christianity, which they are sincerely doing, both Ye and Nick, it seems sincere to me. And I think that's a very different story than connecting with white nationalism or anti-Jewism or things like that. You know, so I think it could be more powerful and make a lot of Christians listen. I don't know. It's hard. It's a hard sell. It's a hard sell for sure.
Well, we will definitely see what happens in the new year. And Carolyn, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Thank you so
much. Oh, it's too bad we can't talk about the semi-revisionism.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, we could talk about that. I'm sorry. I totally had spaced that topic. Yeah, you know what? Let's cover that real quick and then we'll wrap up.
Yeah,
and this stems from – I know you had sent me a message the other day about it. This stems from like a comment thread that you had sort of been participating in over on UNS.com, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it just came up. It just came up then. And, well, let's see. I just here it is. It's something that it interests me because people are saying well, semi-revisionism is all right, but if you go any further than that, then they don't agree with it or something. I think it's not understood. And my question would be to you, understanding that semi-revisionism has been associated with David Irving and also David Cole, that Jewish revisionist, used to be a revisionist, not anymore. Or he says he is, but he's not. He's a semi-revisionist. They don't call it that. But, and also Mark Weber fits into that because Mark Weber has adopted. They're both following what David Irving came up with after his ordeals in prison and in Austria and so on, that and his claim that he's not a Holocaust denier, that that he believes that while there were no gas chambers and no murders at Auschwitz, at least by gas chamber, but there were gas chambers in the in the three camps in on the eastern eastern border of Poland at the time, which was Belzec. They want to call them the Reinhardt camps, but I'm kind of getting why I don't want to call them that. They're Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. Treblinka is the one most people hear about. And that's the one where supposedly most deaths took place. But this is so controversial. So they've moved, as you know, a long time ago, they moved the Holocaust killing out to those three camps, the majority of it, because they couldn't maintain what they were saying about Auschwitz-Birkenau. Even when they still said there were gas chambers there, they couldn't maintain those numbers, you know, to add up to 6 million. So they moved them over to these camps. And it was such a, I mean, you can see that they did that. And yet how it's done, and as long as it's, people don't look into it that deeply, for one thing, and then they just accept what's being said. And they say, just like I did back then, well, if they're saying all this, they must have evidence. They, you know, something must have happened there. They must know what they're talking about. No, they don't. But that takes a while to realize. So what we have here is people were praising David Irving as doing more for revisionism than all the other revisionists combined, because of his trials and all the suffering he went through that the Jews put upon him. And, you know, he just they just destroyed the poor man. And I brought that up. I said, well, wait a minute. You know, he says there's still 2,500 Jews murdered in the Holocaust. He's gone back to that after joining with the revisionists after the Fred Leuchter report, you know, and the Zundel trials in the 80s. And now he's gone back to that 2 million. Did I say 2 million or 2,500,000 Jews? And that's a lot, you know, that's a lot. And it didn't happen. And it's not true. But he's sticking with this. And
Carolyn, there's not even any legitimate evidence for that.
There's no forensic evidence. There's no bodies.
There's nothing yet.
There's only this paper that said that they sent these Jews there, that many of them. And that might not be true either. And plus, you know, if we had time, which we don't, I know, but the Udo Alendi, I had some notes here about his key documents at the IMT. Well, he talked about a number of key documents that prove that Hitler wanted to kill all the Jews. And then Alendi showed that none of these documents were any good. You know, not even documents. There are papers that they were found, or that they actually typed up and said they found them, that they used at the IMT. They don't have any official signatures or seals, or some of them are just retyped things from copies of something. And, you know, anyway, so that's the story of their documents. You know, you can't, they use things, they make things up. So I don't know, but this Kohair is pretty much believed in by most people, but it only says that they're going to move these people there. They might not have. I take the position that all those, that number of Jews, several million, were not taken to these camps and left there. And we know that a lot of them were sent elsewhere afterward. Why they'd go there and then send them elsewhere, but I don't know. The whole thing is just a mystery, is really what it is. There's nothing you can believe in about it. It's they make things up and then they make up a theory. So this is this, you can't. I say, what is revision? If you did people do this because they like David Irving, or they're partial to the English and not to the Germans. Some of it is that, you know. And so they want to build up David Irving. And so I called him an opportunist, but that's just because, but that's not what's important. What's important is, what is revisionism? You know, and I think, see where I had it, but I think it needs to be defined. And I have this, I got this idea now that revisionism, we've been dealing with revisionism 101. You know how in college you take 101 classes in your first year of all the subjects that you're in taking. And if you're majoring in something, you when the next year or two, you move up to what are in the number 201 numbers, two something. And then you move up to the three numbers when you get to be a senior or something. And then you go on to graduate school. You don't stay at 101. And I learned that kind of late, that everything I had was one, was in the beginning. I didn't know there was a difference. I had all these courses, but they were all beginner courses, you know, the beginning ones. And that's what we've been talking about, the beginning aspects or elements of revisionism, 6 million gas chambers, this and that. I know it's basic, but for a lot of people, they could go beyond that. I think there's a lot more to say about that would be damning for this than to just be stuck in these beginning courses. So that's my idea. We need to discuss revisionism. And now it's called denial, Holocaust denial. And I was going to write about that and arguing, you know, it's kind of an argument against it, to say how did it come about? Because this is Jewish. This is the Jews' language, you know, and they push their language on us. So, but then as I started, I thought, you know, I've come to like Holocaust denial. I believe I can say I'm a denier. I do deny it. And so what's wrong with that? And I'm I think that needs to be, have a little reassessment too. Because revisionism, the idea of it, they won't use the word revisionism. We use the word revisionism, but what does it mean? What are we revising it? Or are we saying, you know, like you have said today, it doesn't mean that nothing happened. You know, it doesn't mean, we're not saying that there weren't any camps and Jews weren't deported to camps and Jews didn't have a hard time. But what we are saying is what these camps were, and that's just not true. They weren't death camps. There were no death camps. And so we have to get a little beyond this, because I still have revisionism and truth for Germany in my blood, you know, and I don't find anything more important than that to move on to. But I'm a little, let me just end this way, discouraged when I go to where it's being discussed and the arguments are on such a low level. And if you say, well, you're on too low of a level, then that doesn't go over too well, because, you know.
That just creates more conflict. Yeah. You know, I tend to actually totally agree with you. I mean, this whole semantics game about, you know, are you a Holocaust denier? Are you a revision? I mean, it's the same thing with racist or anti-Semite. I mean,
exactly.
If you're going to call me that, like, okay, whatever. But I think I would explain myself a little bit differently. And I don't frankly care about these labels anymore, because all they are is weaponized buzzwords used to just slander and demonize and tarnish anybody.
Yeah, but they're used everywhere. They're used all the time.
And I mean, if you look at like the literal definition of like to deny, like the verb deny, it means is to state that something is not true.
And yeah, or you don't agree with it.
I'm a Holocaust denier in the fact that I deny, I'm stating that this story is not true. And that statement is backed up by all sorts of legitimate evidence and documentation that has been systematically compiled by people with, you know, expertise in these matters. I mean, this is not like we just are making this up and, you know, we have nothing to offer to demonstrate what we're saying. That's what kills me. That's what's so frustrating, is like the work that all of these men have done over the years. And I mean, maybe David Irving fits in there to a certain extent, but I'm speaking more of like, you know, Carlo Montonio and Farison and Leuchter and Guillermo Rudolph, who is now in all sorts of, you know, he's all sorts of problems going on. It seems like I don't even know all the details.
Yeah, I don't either, but I've heard it, and I feel terrible. I just stay quiet, but yeah. You know, they're not leaving him alone.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, these guys have gone through and just, I mean, systematically taken this entire story apart from start to finish. I mean, there's virtually no aspect of the official Holocaust story that's true, and I know that's a hard thing for people to entertain, but I mean, that's the reality of the situation, and this entire thing has just been totally distorted and concocted and manufactured and literally implanted in our brains through very evil, psychologically manipulative propaganda, and that has got to end. That is
so I'm saying, taking a different direction, maybe, you know, looking at it in a different way is what I would like to do. Not always is was it wasn't 6 million. That's so simple to me. Of course it wasn't, and we've got all kinds of material on that, so that there's no point in arguing about that. And then, you know, was there this, was there that? That's just, it bores people. It's not new. And I think there's other things to be said that would attack this Jewish control that we're talking about, even with people like Ye and Fuentes, that could be helpful. And we need to use different methods and go about it. And it all ties together because it's all about Jewish control, which is what the Jews have successfully made everybody scared to say, you know, or you can't talk about it unless you're in the Barnes Review. And I want to say, when you sent me that copy of my article in the Barnes Review, it just brought back, you know, that the Barnes Review is the only thing we have now, the only thing we have that does this. And it's struggling. And of course it is. We need to do a better job of supporting our movement. And so we need to quit just spending our time on forums arguing about 6 million or not. That's, we need to upgrade. We need to do a better job.
Hey, well said. I 100% agree. And that's a position that I've had for a long time. I mean, really, the Barnes Review is the only publication that's out there. Mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. only organization that is willing to publish and sell these sorts of books and to, you know, put out a magazine that is, I mean, more or less, I mean, it's not solely focused on, you know, Holocaust revisionism or World War II revisionism, but that is a huge aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm frankly interested in all aspects of history, especially Western, European, American history. And our history needs a lot of revising, a lot of fact checking, a lot of reassessing. And that's really what the Barnes Review is dedicated to. And I see no other publication or outlet or organization that's even remotely close to, you know, pursuing those sorts of goals. So I agree. And that's why I encourage everybody to subscribe.
Yeah. But you know, the Jews have done this. They've succeeded in cutting everything, pushing everything out of the way and making everything go bankrupt and so on. So we have to find a way to get around that. And this same old is not doing it. It's not going to do it. And we need to be smarter and not lazy. There's so much laziness in white people. I don't know why they give themselves this great reputation. It's from people in the past, you know, when people weren't lazy, but we're lazy today. And we've been kind of probably, you know, indoctrinated into it and turned into defeatists and so on. And just all the things that they do. But we need more people working, or we need smarter. We need something. And now here I am, too old to do all this. So it's your job, John.
Hey, well, you know what? You can only do so much, and I'm certainly trying. So,
yeah.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much. It was so great to catch up with you. It's been way too long, and I'm really glad to have you back on to have this conversation. You've done so much work over the years. You really are a legend in the revisionist movement, the revisionist cause, however you want to frame it. or just outright Holocaust denial cause or whatever it is. But bringing history into accord with the facts, I like that. That of course is the motto of the Barnes Review, named after Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes. That was his goal in you know writing about history, and I think that's certainly something you've been doing for a long time. That's something that the Barnes Review tries to do in every issue. And that's something we certainly need more of in our society. So thank you so much. Yeah, for joining me.
Let me say one last thing.
Yeah.
I was looking for this statement. It came from the Barnes Review that's coming out this month, in January. And it was an article about Rivarol, a French right-wing magazine. And they say in there that this magazine has kept, you know, kept to its original intentions, and it's very. And here's something that they say that I thought really resonated with me. So I'll leave this as parting words. Nothing is more remote to us than the spirit of compromise, concession, moderation, which are words that often conceal compromises and sellouts. I've always felt this way. Some people feel differently. So there you are.
Yes. Yeah, I know exactly the line you're referring to. And that'll be something that I'll probably speak with the author of that article on a future podcast in the next couple of weeks. Yeah, that's Remy Tremblay, who's been a guest. Yeah. Yeah, he's a very solid writer, very good researcher. And yeah, so we will definitely get to that. And I 100% agree with that sentiment. It's very, very powerful and totally resonates with me.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, Carolyn, thank you so much. Best of luck in the new year. And yeah, we'll stay in touch and maybe do this again in the future.
All righty, John. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate
thanks.
It. Bye.
Yep. No problem. Take care.